This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The Malaysia Human Development Report is a study commissioned by the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, to provide an independent assessment of Malaysia's growth and development policy choices in its quest to achieve developed country status by 2020. 30 national experts contributed research and insights into all aspects of Malaysia's economy. One of those experts is University of Malaya's Associate Professor of Law, Dr. Azmi Sharum, whose paper is on the law and its implication on inclusiveness. He joins me in the studio to discuss that. So the first issue that you had to confront when thinking about law and inclusivity is balancing the principle of equality against the value of fairness. How does one go about doing that? Those are very lofty ideals, it sounds like.
Equality does not necessarily mean fair. Because you can't treat everyone equally. A child cannot be treated equally as an adult for crimes, for example. There are some situations where women and men should not be treated equally. Maternity leave, logically, should be longer than paternity leave. But how do you deal with situations where you have to treat people unequally, but in as fair a manner as possible? I think that was the thing that I was trying to raise.
And I suppose, as generally as possible as well, right, without kind of picking up individual cases and saying, well, in such and such a case, it would be like this and so on and so forth.
Yeah, if you treat people unequally on an individual case, that means you're giving a lot of discretion, and that's actually against the rule of law as well. So that's not the way to do it. But I think what we're talking about here primarily is, because it's about inclusiveness, it's about making society a fairer society. And doing so might require you to treat people in an unequal manner.
Quotas are a sticky subject. You wrote that the establishment of quotas can be justified to create an inclusive society. What are these justifications?
Well, it has to be, you have to have a clear objective as to why you want to do it. And you have to also have, you need to have it has to be planned very, very carefully. But more importantly, you have to have a method of review in order to make sure that it's working, or if it's not working, because this is not something that should be in perpetuity. Unequal treatment, the ideal, of course, is equality, right? So when you do treat people unequally, for reasons of economics, for example, then you have to be very, very clear about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and you have to have the space, the room, with which to be able to analyze it, discuss it, and if it's not needed anymore, get rid of it.
Or adapt it, I suppose.
Or adapt it if it's not working.
You also cited the Belgian linguistic case of 1968 in the paper. What was the complaint and what principle did that case invoke?
Okay, that case was actually about language, the language used in schools in Belgium. Because, you have Belgians who speak French, and then I think I'm not quite sure what the other language is. And depending on
Flemish,
which,
I think.
Yeah, Flemish. Who speaks Flemish except the Belgians? It was about a French-speaking family who lived in a Flemish area and felt that they were being treated unequally because they wanted a French-speaking school. So it's got nothing to do about inclusiveness as such, but the principles have been used by human rights organizations, UN human rights bodies. And what are the principles? The principles are basically what I spoke about just now. If you want to treat people unequally, you can, but it has to be a clear objective, it has to be for good reason, and there has to be the democratic space with which to discuss it.
Meritocracy is a word that I think we tend to throw around an awful lot in national discussions.
Not as much as down south. But yeah.
Well, no, but still. So is pure meritocracy a flawed concept to organize our society around?
I think it's a good ideal, and it's a necessary ideal. And so any situation where you go against the ideal has to be very well justified. Of course, there can never be pure meritocracy in situations, for example, in education. I think There has to be consideration taken into children from rural areas, for example, you know, things like that. But what we mustn't lose track of is the fact that meritocracy is probably the best way to move forward anyway. So let's keep that as an ideal and be careful if you're going to mess around with it.
Your example of education and poverty, I suppose, is a very interesting one because there's always this discussion about what it will take in order to change the poverty cycle. And having said that, should laws on affirmative action then be crafted with the poor in mind in perpetuity? Or is that, in a sense, in its own way, perpetuating the poverty cycle?
No, it's if it's done well, it doesn't perpetuate poverty. I don't think anything should be done in perpetuity, especially affirmative action, because if you're not achieving what you set out to do, then you failed, you know. And once you've achieved it, then you stop. If you look at the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, for example, it does allow for affirmative action to get women up to the same level as men. But it very clearly says that once that's achieved, then you stop. You know, so I don't believe in it, affirmative action being done perpetuity. That's why it's very, very important to have your objectives and to know when you've achieved your objectives and then to stop.
So when we say, you know, it's important to know these objectives and to review them as and when, who are we talking about? Who are the people who should be doing that?
Anyone who wants to. You know, researchers, the government, universities, whoever wants to. And this is what I mean by democratic space, you see. So if you have a system and then you say, oh, you cannot talk about it, then you'll never know whether the thing is working or not, right? And I think that's the problem we have over here.
So at this point in time then, what forms of treating, of having unequal fair treatment, I suppose, or discriminatory practices or preferential treatment is allowed within and under our constitution?
Specifically, only matters on education, which is, for example, places in educational establishments and scholarships. Government service, quotas in government service, and also licenses, business licenses. These are the only three things which are specifically mentioned in the Constitution.
From a legal perspective, are there any grounds in which the new economic policy could be challenged in court?
Yeah, sure, of course. You know, and, you know, if something's unconstitutional or if it's done outside the boundaries set by the Constitution, whatever it might be, of course it can be challenged in court. You know, so like I said, the Constitution is very clear. It says we have Article 8, which is about equality, and it says everyone's equal. But there are situations where you can be treated unequally, but only in situations which are specifically laid out in the Constitution. So if something is being done and it's not within the Constitution, you know, and if affirmative action is being carried out, but it's not something which is allowed for by the Constitution, then it's theoretically unconstitutional and therefore can be challenged.
The weaknesses of a race-based affirmative action policy is one that's been discussed, but would a class-based quota contravene Article 8?
That's actually a jolly good question. Right, I'm thinking now. Well, it depends because, you see, Article 8 says that you cannot be discriminated, you have to be treated equally regardless of race, gender, religion. It doesn't say anything about class or poverty. So it's, you know, if I would argue that if the purpose of the affirmative action is poverty alleviation and it is across the board, that means there's no distinction. It's, you know, so long as you're poor, it doesn't matter what color you are, doesn't matter what religion you are, then I don't think it would go against Article 8.
Could it be argued that at this moment in time, removing affirmative action would do more towards a more inclusive development of society?
No, of course not, because we have poor people in this country. We're not a rich country, you know, and there's definitely a gap, you know, a wealth gap. You know, seriously, some kid from some small town, you know, whose parents are labourers, do not have the same advantages as a rich kid in PJ who can go to tuition and has internet and computers and stuff like that. You know, we have an unequal society. So, you know, you have to take measures.
So I suppose then, based on what we've discussed so far, the idea here is that it's fine so long as there is room for discussion and review.
Yes, that's the most important thing, actually, because we need to be free to assess any activities which is taken.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Azmi Sharam, Associate Professor of Law in University of Malaya. We are discussing law and its implication on inclusiveness in light of the Malaysia Human Development Report. Up next, we move on to gender and women on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. With me in the studio is Dr. Azmi Sharam, Associate Professor of Law at University of Malaya. We are discussing law and its implication on inclusiveness. So in the first half, we focused on quotas, on affirmative action. Now we're moving on to the subject of women. Malaysia added the term gender into Article 8 of the Constitution back in 2001. What was the significance of this amendment?
It's just to clarify that women are equal to men.
In case
you didn't realize that, you know. I mean, you know, some people, you know, it has to be spelled out. And also, I think it was in order for us to make a move towards compliance with CEDAW. That's why they put it in.
And was last year a particularly good year for gender equality? I suppose the bigger question is, since 2001, in those intervening years, have we seen any sort of major movements in the courts when it comes to gender equality?
There have been some minor movements. I wouldn't say that any major movements because, I mean, look at our cabinet, for example. How many ministers are women? How many MPs are women? How many judges are women? How many CEOs are women? You know, we're still a very gender imbalanced society. There have been a few bright sparks in relation to CEDAW. There was a case of Nora Fadila, a teacher who lost her job because she was pregnant. And the court held that this was clearly against CEDAW because you cannot be discriminated against because of pregnancy. And so that was good. That was the a court of law taking an international law and applying it in our context.
On that note, CEDAW is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women.
It's a mouthful, isn't it?
The acronym's a lot snazzier, yeah. I must admit. So with that change, or rather addition into Article 8, with that decision, how compliant is Malaysia's law with CEDAW at this point in time?
I think the problem is that there are quite a few reservations which Malaysia made on CEDAW. A lot of it's got to do because of religious issues where certain religious principles or Islamic law do not tally with CEDAW. And they've made reservations on some of those points, some of those articles. But overall, I mean, I think that's what you're asking me, right? Overall,
how well are we doing?
Oh man! I'm too gender insensitive. I think we could do better. There's certain aspects which are clearly very good. Women in higher education, for example, outnumber men.
Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel I'm teaching in a convent. All right. it's all women. The guys are sleeping in the back. But I think there's still a long way to go. And that's the whole point about CEDAW. CEDAW allows for a more proactive approach towards equality. And that is something we have to embrace the ideas. And it will take time. It's not something that can happen overnight. Just because we are party to it doesn't mean that it's going to, you know, suddenly
automatically change everything.
Yeah, gender equality is going to happen.
There was an earlier case involving Beatriz Fernandez where she was forced to resign because of pregnancy. Why did she lose that case in 2005?
Right. If I'm not mistaken, the lawyers did not argue CEDAW. All right. They were arguing based on the Constitution. If I'm not mistaken, she was a stewardess and she got pregnant and she was fired, essentially. And the court decided that she was treated equally with other women workers because they all had the same contract, which I don't think is the point, because the point is, you know, are you being treated equally with men, with the stewards? But also another rather disturbing point was that they said that because MAS was a private company, the constitutional principles do not apply. I think that's wrong. I think constitutional principles apply everywhere across the board, you know, because then otherwise, you know, private companies can do all sorts of things that you know, take away our rights.
Precisely, though. So does that mean that this case provided room in that space for the private sector to continue to be discriminatory in this manner and in others?
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of the common law. There are other cases which said opposite. So the Bharat Estates case, for example, it says that constitutional provisions do apply even in a private situation. So it's, you know, both cases are not the highest court. So it's not something which is final in my point of view. It's still arguable. So there are cases where it says that you must respect the constitution even if you're a private company. So we'll see. We'll see how it develops.
Could you remind us what the Bharat Estates decision was?
Well, I can't remember exactly the facts of the case, but basically it was about principles regarding labor and forced labor. You know, you can't, because slavery is not allowed. Forced labor is not allowed in the constitution. So a company has to respect that. You know, basically that's it.
Right at the top of the interview, you mentioned that children cannot be treated equally to adults for obvious reasons. And on that topic, the Child Act was recently in the news because of a proposed move to abolish court-sanctioned caning of children. Is the Act comprehensive in its articulation of a child's rights?
The Child Act?
Yes.
The Child Act is only really about the child and the criminal justice system. It's not a holistic law. It's only about that, you know, when a child enters into the legal system or criminal justice system, then how do you protect the child? It doesn't deal with education, for example, or health or anything like that. So it's a very narrow law, you know. So by far, it's not comprehensive.
Yesterday marks 20 years since Malaysia acceded to the Convention on the Rights of the Child in 1995, of which the four core principles are non-discrimination, best interests of the child, the right to life, survival and development, and respect for the views of the child. At this point in time, are we still lacking in any of these aspects?
Respect of the views of the child? They've got nothing to say. There's children. I think there are certain things, education in particular. It's worrying that although our constitution gives a right to education, it's really for citizens only. So we have loads and loads, thousands of children who are children of migrants or refugees who don't have access to education. Now, it's not their fault. In their legal status, it's not their fault, and their future should not be taken away from them because of something which is completely out of their control. And, that's one example of how things can improve.
Moving back to the amendment to the Child Act, there was some backlash from parents and religious leaders who misunderstood and thought that parents then could be jailed for caning their children. In some way, though, shouldn't all forms of corporal punishment on children be banned if we do want to adhere to the Convention of the Rights of the Child?
Because the convention does say that you can't torture a child. Although I think we've made a reservation on that as well.
And also, I suppose, what constitutes torture depends.
Yeah. There have been international cases where caning has been held to constitute torture. So, strictly speaking, legally, if we've made a reservation, then we don't have to follow it. I think the question of whacking kids is something which we need to discuss a bit more, really.
And the indigenous population is arguably the most marginalized community in Malaysia. How much protection do they have legally to preserve their culture, land, and way of life?
Depends where you are. If you're on the peninsula, then very little. The indigenous peoples of Sabah and Sarawak have more laws which are useful to protect their rights. But on the peninsula, we only have the Aboriginal Peoples Act, and that's not very good. It's not very protective law at all.
What caused that difference in laws between
Sabah and Sarawak?
The South China Sea, basically?
Because it's politics. The indigenous peoples of Sabah and Sarawak are a larger group of people, therefore they are politically stronger, whereas the Orang Asli on the peninsula are a very small group and very poor. And of course, you know, it's exactly that kind of group that gets marginalized, isn't it?
So in what ways then can we kind of try and ensure some form of equality when we're talking about the indigenous population in Malaysia as a whole?
I think a good step would be to look at the principles in the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and try to incorporate some of those principles into law. Because it's a declaration, it means it's a soft law. And being a soft law, you can use it to lobby and to argue, but you can't use it in court. The courts won't accept it. You know, so unless we take those principles and actually make them Malaysian laws, I think that's a good first step.
So on that note, for some clarification then, you said soft law. So for those who are uninitiated, you know, right. When we talk about things like conventions, when we talk about things like declarations, what does it mean? Because, you know, we do make a big deal about these things when we join them or, you know, we trumpet them more often than not. But What does it really mean?
Okay, basically, international laws, when you talk about international laws, treaties and conventions, they're the same thing. You know, they're actually proper agreements with clear obligations, clear rights, clear duties. Whereas declarations are just a statement of principle. And so they don't fall under the classification of what is a treaty or what is a convention. Therefore, they're known as soft law. Declarations are known as soft law. They're merely, they might have some moral obligation, but not a legal obligation. That's the difference.
So in other words, if I say that I'm, you know, I agree with this declaration, I'm joining this declaration, I'm essentially saying I agree with the principle of it, but I don't necessarily have to immediately practice it.
It's that's why it's so good to trumpet those things, because you don't have to do anything.
It's lots of fun. You sound really good.
You sound really good. Yeah, you know, but...
So what about the treatment of workers and labourers? What rights do the working population have?
Well, you know, we have labour laws which provide some, you know, some rights to workers. I think the greatest problems are unions. Although we can unionise, the primary power of a union is to strike. But the trade union laws makes it very difficult for unions to actually strike. You know, you actually have to put your, you know, first you have to get everybody, all your people, all your members, and then there has to be a vote, and then there has to be a very large majority who agree. And then after that, you've got to sort of like send this proposal to strike to the ministry. I mean, like, good heavens, you're supposed to strike. Why should we get permission? You know, so we have trade unions, but they are kind of emasculated by the law.
So trade unions at this point have the right to form, have the right to be, but not necessarily, but they're quite curtailed, is that the...
Yeah, very curtailed.
And the Persons with Disabilities Act 2008 seems pretty comprehensive. Any complaints there?
I think it's the law is good, but how well is it enforced? I think that's the key thing. We just have to look around. I mean, you know, because everybody drives, right? You know, just walk from one point to another, and then imagine yourself in a wheelchair, and you see our curbs are humongous, you know, and our sidewalks are dangerous, or they don't exist, you know. So it's things like that which really get in the way, you know. How much of our public transport is accessible to the disabled? These are key things, because you know, the important thing is that if you're a person with disability, you have to be able to work, you have to be able to get an education, you have to be able to get to your work, you have to be able to get to your education. And although the law is I think it's not a bad law, there's much to be desired with regards to its implementation.
And similarly, you know, with the difference between a convention and a declaration, what is the difference between having a law and enforcing that law? You know, how big is that gulf and transition between those two things?
Well, it depends on the agencies, yeah, the enforcement agencies, and it also depends on political will. You know, just if you have, because a lot of laws just tell us don't do something. You know, don't drive too fast. But there are some laws which require a slightly more proactive approach. And that will really depend on whether the government of the day wants to take that proactive approach, so it really depends, you know, on who's in charge and what their objectives are.
But laws can also still serve that protective purpose, right?
Sure.
So having said that then, has there been any legal action that have been brought to institutions that haven't accommodated special needs or have...
For the disabled?
Yes.
I'm not sure. I don't think so. Not to my knowledge, but I could be wrong.
But could there be?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
Right. On the basis of discrimination?
On the basis of discrimination, yes.
So... We've covered children, women.
We've covered quite a lot, actually.
Hopefully it's been an inclusive interview in terms of who we've covered. So what message then would you like to leave us with regarding the law and its implication on inclusiveness?
Right now, the laws that we have with regards to inclusiveness is rather ad hoc. It's something here, something there. There doesn't seem to be an overall policy. There was suggested a social inclusion bill, which proposed setting up a social inclusion commission, which is independent from government, which reports to Parliament, and which lays down, you know, broad principles and broad policies with regards to inclusiveness by looking at all the problems that we have in the country. I think that's where we should be going, rather than just dealing with things in an ad hoc manner.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Dr. Azmi Sharam, Associate Professor of Law at University Malaya. We've been discussing law and its implication on inclusiveness on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.5.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.